From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 31, recorded Monday, August 28th, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Codesmith Tools, makers of Codesmith, an extensible template-based code generator for .NET. Hansel Minutes listeners get $100 off Codesmith Professional with coupon code HM100, online at codesmithtools.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine, online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott discusses test-driven development.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes. I'm here with Scott once again. Hi, Scott.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. So we got some email addressing our dynamic languages show.
Yeah, we got a lot of email about it, actually, and we got some good, some kind of good, some mediocre. I think a lot of people took us to task or took umbrage at some of the assumptions that we were making about when you move from a compiler-based model to a test-based model, that before the compiler did a lot of checking for you, and now I'm saying that the testing does a lot of checking for you, but the argument that test-driven development saves you lines of code is kind of a specious argument, I think, was the assumption.
Yeah, I think that's the gist of it, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think that you made a really good point that many people called out, which was that having lots and lots of unit tests and having good test coverage is a very different thing from test-driven development formally.
Right. Test first.
Yeah,
methodologies.
Particularly our one of our writers who was emailed us is David Leon, who thought that if he's got to go and write 168 water tests just to validate something, then is that really a beneficial thing? And I think he was basically calling me out on test-driven development as it relates to dynamic languages is, they're really totally separate things. I was basically saying that there's a certain freedom that a dynamic language offers you, but that is a totally separate thing from doing test-driven development. So I figured let's just do a show on TDD and talk about it.
Okay. Great.
So, the general idea of test-driven development, like the mantra is write a test that fails. So like step one, write a test and cause it to fail. Usually it will fail because the stuff that you're trying to test doesn't exist yet.
You haven't written the code yet, right?
Exactly. Number two is fix the code so then you can pass the test. And then number three, which is often forgotten, but is really kind of the whole point of test-driven development specifically, which is refactor the code. Refactor ruthlessly is what people like to say.
Right.
And then step four, rinse, repeat. Right?
Yeah.
So yes, it's true. Test-driven development isn't necessarily allowing you to write less code, although from a design perspective, it can. When you are sitting down writing code, test first, and this is Greenfield's fresh stuff, right? When you're writing from scratch, really test-driven development is allowing you to become your own client, right? You are the client of the code. You get to sit down and say, in a perfect world, if I were to write this framework, how would it behave from the outside? Scott Belware has a really great essay that we'll post up about this called Write Naive Tests. Basically say, this is how it ought to work. Become your own client.
It's a tinyurl.hb3cw. And the reason we're using tinyurl today is because shrinkster.com is effectively down.
Yeah, somehow it's disappeared, but we're going to hook up with that guy and try to find his database and get him back up.
Right. We'll figure that out.
But all of these links will be up on the site, so you'll be able to reference these at the show site or at my blog.
Okay.
So test-driven development at the purest sense is become your own client, okay? But remember, step one, write a test that fails. Step two, fix the code. Step three, refactor. One of the benefits, really kind of the primary benefit of test-driven development is that it lets you refactor very freely, right? It gives you a formal suite of tests that are lying out there that you can run against your code whenever you want. Now, test-driven development doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a unit testing framework, right? It doesn't mean you have to use NUnit or you have to use team system test. And certainly in the 80s when people were writing test code in C++, they were just writing little test programs or they'd write their own testing library. They didn't have a formalized method early on until things like ComUnit and some of the early, even before that, the early C++ unit testing stuff came out. But it lets you refactor freely. And this is what Fowler was talking about when he wrote in refactoring, and that's at refactoring.com, is that if you've got this netting that's protecting you, right? If you can climb up the mountain and do something crazy and someone will catch you when you fall, it is those tests that will catch you. So it is that ability to refactor ruthlessly. There's a person who's got a great essay on test-driven development where they say refactor without fear and refactor ruthlessly. This is at, we'll post this up there. This is Apurva Muralidhara has an essay on test-driven development.
That's at JPBAA. And refactor ruthlessly is at H3QM7.
And this individual says that the coding cycle is red, green, refactor. That's a really great way to remember the rules of test-driven development. So it's really that ability. So that's first benefit, that ability to refactor freely and rip the guts out of stuff. We recently refactored some stuff. Patrick Caldwell, my buddy at work, ripped the complete guts out of a chunk of code that we had. But we had 150, 160 unit tests backing that up. And they were almost a specification, right? These unit tests read like specification code. Right. So we were able to yank out the middle part of that service and replace it with a much faster implementation. And the tests were our guide. The thing that was significant is that when the tests passed, we knew we were done.
Right.
Right. So this is one of the things that the test-driven purists will say is that write the simplest possible code to let the test pass.
Yeah.
Right. And then when the test passes, you're done. If you don't feel done, you know that there's more work to be done, then write another test as opposed to expand on the code. And the design folks who say that test-driven development improves your design, it makes it more flexible, it makes it more extensible, it makes it easier to maintain. These are the people who are refactoring while they're writing their code, because you shouldn't be refactoring unless there's something about the test or something about about a test that uncovers an aspect of the design that says, ooh, this test just pushed the specification, just pushed the application into a new world, into a new location, and oh, I see an opportunity now to refactor. I will refactor and I'll see if all my tests still pass. So, like we did point out before, but I didn't say really explicitly last time, you sometimes will write a lot more code in your tests than in your actual code. You'll spend more time writing tests. Whether people feel that is a good thing or a bad thing, some people say that's silly, right? Because when we were talking about dynamic languages last week, we were saying that in the application that my 16-year-old intern wrote, he ended up writing more code in the test than he did in the code itself.
Right, right.
Number of people said, well, that's not exactly a step forward. It really depends. It depends on how complicated the application is.
It also depends on what the application is meant to be. I mean, how many times have you written an application that you're going to run once, you know, to convert some data or doing some other kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. And that might not be an application you want to apply test-driven development to at all. But an application where there's a lot of, you know, maybe a small app, but there's a lot of potential unknown input, or an application that needs to be very secure, you want to use a lot of negative unit tests. Really beat on the thing and see if it'll stop. The other thing is that when you're done is really up to you. Some people use test coverage, right? The percentage of code paths that have been covered as an I'm done metric. They'll use tools like ncover at ncover.org and the ncover explorer. And sometimes they'll tie all of that stuff together with things like testdriven.net, Jamie Cansdale's testdriven.net, which is at www.testdriven.net. Those tools will allow you to right click in Visual Studio and say run tests, or right click and say test with coverage. And there's one individual at my work who just refuses to check anything out. Excuse me, refuses to check anything in, rather, to source control unless it has 100% coverage. Now, that's not necessarily reasonable for every application, but some people say, you know, if you can get 50, 60, 70% of your code covered, that means that after every single build, that chunk of code is running. And arguably, if you do test-driven development and the test really wags the code, you won't write any code that isn't run by a test.
Yeah.
because the tests are driving the code. So it is possible to get that kind of test coverage.
Do you use a refactor from Developer Express or ReSharper or both? What's your take on that? I really love refactor from Dev Express. In particular, I love the kind of graphical tools that show you things like cyclomatic complexity and the sort of the arrows and things that Mark draws all over the screen.
Yeah, the stuff going on in CodeRush and Refactor from DevExpress is really great at knowing, is this code too complicated?
Yeah.
There's a lot of really cool templates. Where you can actually say like TF and it'll build a whole test framework for you.
A lot of built-in intelligence. He's trying to read your mind basically, and it does a pretty good job.
Totally.
Yeah.
Now the JetBrains, the guys that make ReSharper, have a similar tool, not exactly like CodeRush, but similar. But that also has a CodeRush beat when it comes to analysis of code, kind of real-time compilation and analysis of code. Hmm. But they also have a built-in test runner of their own that will run unit tests that you have within your project that are built in either NUnit or in an alternative unit testing framework called CSUnit. And that is integrated within Visual Studio for those of us who aren't using Team System Tester.
Mm-hmm.
And it also allows inline profiling. So you can actually click on a test, say run this test, debug this test, or profile it using the JetBrains .trace profiler. And that's a sweet profile if you've ever used .trace. Fantastic stuff. Which is interesting. If you think about profiling a test, remembering that the test is a client of the code that you're actually writing,
mm-hmm.
the code that you're writing in the is being wagged, right? If you can send a wag the dog kind of a sense,
sure.
by the test that you're writing. So then why not use it as an opportunity to profile sections of the code that you know are going to be really slow? And I like to look at alternative frameworks because a lot of people think, well, it's either Team System or it's NUnit. But there was also, for a while, a kind of an upstart that was called MBUnit, written by a guy named Pelly, who had an original article up on Code Project. Well, you have your tiny URL for that.
Tiny URL 16OWO. That's not zero. 16OWO.
And Pelly wrote an article on codeproject.com about this potential unit testing framework that then turned into MUnit. I'm not quite sure. I'd like to get an email from them to find out if it's abandonware or not. But one of the things that MBUnit did that NUnit does not is the ability to say via attributes, run this test 10 times, or do a data-driven test by pulling data in from somewhere and then do a unit test. Not everything exists in NUnit. There's a lot of timing and it really precise performance counter type timing in things like CSUnit.
Hmm.
But one of the things that's nice is testdriven.net, ReSharper will run those kinds of tests as is. So you could potentially mix and match your unit testing frameworks. There's no reason that you have to use all of one unit testing framework if another meets your needs.
Hmm.
Now, typically we talk about test-driven development within the context of Greenfield. You sit down and you go file new and you start out from fresh. But not everybody necessarily has the chance to do that. Sometimes you need to write unit tests for existing code that may not be particularly pretty. Now, there's a gentleman named Jay Flowers who has a thing called Jay Flowers Doubler. And this is a little confusing, I found, but it's a plug-in to Lutz Rotor's Reflector.
Huh.
And Doubler is a code generator that lets you work with legacy code, and it lets you create basically stubs and wrappers and fake objects around existing code. Because sometimes you can't test a chunk of code if it has a huge number of dependencies.
Right.
So you can kind of break code apart. You can say, this is a great type, but I need to mirror that type with an interface over here and then run generators, run code on that. Then you get into mock objects. I think we'll do a whole show on mock objects.
Yeah, we could probably do a whole show on that.
Yeah. And actually, you know, speaking of people who know a lot about mock objects, you know, Roy Osherov has started writing a book on the art of unit testing.
Wow.
And he's got a separate RSS feed for this book, and he's going to be updating that feed as he goes through his the book writing process. And it's sure to be a great book. Do you've got the URL for that?
Yeah, that's tinyurl/gb952.
Cool. Yeah. Roy is an agile practitioner and definitely someone who knows the difference between test-driven development and then just writing a bunch of tests.
Mm-hmm.
And Now, as far as do I do test-driven development, I have in the past. I've sat down from scratch and started out where I wrote the test first, and I'd have to say that the code did end up simpler. But let me tell you, it's hard. It takes thought to sit down and force yourself to do that, because you just want to go running when you get into the code, and then next thing you know, you've written a chunk of code that you have no tests for. And writing tests is tedious. Frankly,
I think tedious coding practices goes against one of the main reasons why, you know, we got into this business in the first place, which is, you know, to create quickly. I mean, there's a certain satisfaction that comes with, you know, getting your thoughts into electronic form as quick as possible and actually seeing it run.
Definitely. But at the same time, there's a different feeling, and it's hard to explain until you have several hundred or a thousand unit tests, but there's a different feeling when you have a crap load of unit tests and someone comes and says, you know, I think it's a problem in this section of the code. And you say, you know, I'm pretty confident that it's not. And here's why. Or if someone finds a bug and you do the right thing, fix the bug, write a test to confirm that you fixed the bug. Yeah. And then later on, when you add new features, you can actually run regression tests to find out if you broke the fix to that bug.
Yeah.
I talked before about a gentleman who had built in, he'd shipped NUnit with his code. He has a WinForms application.
Right.
And in the help about, you would actually go run tests. So if you ended up calling him for support, he would say, well, go to help about and hit run tests. And he would actually run the tests locally. I thought that was such a creative way to really leverage that code and also find out whether it was running different on his machine versus on the remote
machine. Very cool. Very, very cool.
Totally. Now, the test-driven development is starting to have some people kind of spin off and say, well, we want you to do business-driven development or specification-driven development.
Domain-driven kind of thing.
Well, domain-driven is a little bit different. We'll talk about that in a second. That's a good point. But specification-driven development, they want it to have a more business-like language. So there's a project called NSpec, which is kind of business-driven or what they call behavior-driven development, where it's mostly changing of the naming of things. Like in test-driven development, you mark something as a test and you make assertions. Mm. With NSpec, you would mark something as a specification. Mm. And you would say things like, specify that this should equal that, or specify that this object should not be the same as this object, or that this object should throw an exception. Hmm. You know, it seems kind of weird to me because all they've really done is change the terminology. But there's a number of people who are interested in this way of thinking, of making the spec not be a Word document. Not be some text. We talked before about the notion of a Word document having no teeth.
Yeah. Right?
Word documents don't break builds. But it seems to me that a specification description language, if it happens to be written in the language that you're writing your code in this case in C# or .NET, if a business person can't really express it, then it provides minimal benefit.
Unless there's a tool that can sort of translate between the two worlds.
Right, so then you go into generating your unit tests.
Well, or generating your spec from your unit tests, the other way around.
There are some that think that business people should write the tests themselves, and Ward Cunningham has this notion of FIT. You've heard of FIT, Framework for Integrated Test. This is basically a way to write a test in HTML, right? So Ward and Jim Shore and a bunch of people who work on this, basically, you'd go into Word, you'd write out your specification in prose, and in HTML tables, you'd put in, you know, here's some input, here's an expected output, and then you would actually have a test runner that would look at that Word document, which has now been saved as HTML. Here's the trick, right? Looks at that HTML document, looks at the inputs and the outputs, and this might be written by a business person, and then runs some code harnesses that you've written yourself and plugs in those values and sees if they match what the spec says.
Yeah, well, there's like a little red flag going off in my head, like that possibly can't be, you know, expressive enough.
Well, you know, and it really kind of depends. It depends on if your application has clear boundaries about inputs and outputs. Maybe if you're doing financial calculations or if you're doing an application that's filling out a loan for people, it just depends on the number of inputs. Hmm. if an application is very interactive, yeah, then you might want to look at Ruby or some different web automation tools.
Right, because it seems, I mean, as you get down into the bowels of an application, you know, you're talking about things that, you know, you're using entities that are just beyond the understanding of a business person, you know.
Well, see, that's a very good point. That's a view. Yeah, you're bringing up a fantastic point, because here's the question then.
Where do you draw
the line?
Should
the business person know about this component, right? So then there's the difference between functional testing, right?
Yeah.
And unit testing. Like, a developer might still do unit testing in NUnit or something like that, but the whole service-oriented architecture point of view is really, another person could call it boundary-based programming, right? Because all a service is a component with a very clear boundary. And you could design a service such that it would be reasonable for a business person to describe that. Because if the business person understands that a workflow exists a certain way, there's customer objects and there's invoice objects and vendors, and when a person does this, a vendor should do that, it could very conceivably be reasonable for the business person to describe interactions between these higher level services as they understand them as business people. So they're almost writing kind of an orchestration. Yeah, so it really kind of depends. But, you know, fit is an interesting way, I mean, thinking about HTML tables as orchestration or as programming. I mean, fit can be as simple as someone pushing the buttons automated in an automated fashion on a website. Mm. You can use it in a water-like fashion.
Yeah.
There's also tools like Selenium that allow someone to write code in an HTML table using front page or using Word. At the level that a reasonably technical business person could write. Mm-hmm. But fit isn't explicitly set up for Joe Business Guy to write. But it's just a different way of thinking about the level that you might want to write your test at.
You know, it always occurs to me when we talk about the differences between business-oriented people and programmers is that, you know, really what we ought to be doing is breeding business programmers. You know, programmers who are fully technical and capable, but then, you know, can go and understand the business process as well. I mean, nothing takes the place of somebody with knowledge writing the code. And it seems to me that there's a lot of emphasis placed on, you know, translating between, giving business people tools so that they can, you know, get closer and closer to writing code without actually having to write it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I think you're right on. Because from my point of view, what's the goal, right? Like, if you read like Eli Goldratt's book, The Goal.
the goal is the software that does what it's supposed to do.
Well, in the book, the goal is make more money.
Sure.
Right? So if you think about software, the tools we use to write software, is this thing, whatever it is that we're doing, making us more money?
Right.
Right? You know, so test-driven development's not necessarily going to make you more money. But it may save you money later when you don't have bugs. But what you just said is getting the business person closer to the code.
Or the coder closer to the business, one or the other, right?
Well, so what do programmers do all day? They translate intent into computer instructions. So a business person says, I intend the software to do this. And the programmer, the only thing the programmer is good for is to express that business person's intent in a way that is computerized.
Right.
So if you merge the two and you get business savvy programmers, which are typically called micro ISVs, right? You know, you get like an Eric Sink type who is a coder and a business person, then you can do some serious damage, and they've proven it out in their company.
Sure.
Right? And you get people like Mark.
Right. Cause I mean, we all know the downside to programmers who just do exactly what they're told. You know, they tend not to get hired. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
If you can't be in the middle of something and recognize that it needs to change.
If the business person can express the intent in some format that the programmer can consume more readily than a Word document, then that business document has teeth. At Carillion, it's usually custom XML documents where our business person will be able to read XML in the most basic sense, or possibly use a tool like InfoPath to express their intent.
Mm.
In some kind of a domain-specific language. Fit is an example of a domain-specific language for expressing functional intent. You can write these yourself. Things like Ruby spec or NSpec are ways to move in that direction. So if the person can say, this meets the business need and I can assert it in a in a programmatic way, then like we've said in the past, the number of non-software artifacts approaches zero.
Do you think it's a good idea maybe for people on the beginning process of a project to give the business people to write an application for the business people to help them express what they what they need to get done in the code? So that's more specific to their domain, something that's less off the shelf.
Well, yeah, I think rapid prototyping is a way of commiserating, of getting together with the business person and saying, did you mean this? Right? So yeah. I think, yeah, you're right. Anything that a programmer can do to express to the business person, yeah, that's what I meant.
Or a tool to help them
totally
express it, right? A tool that they can use however their domain dictates that can generate XML or can generate C# or VBNet or whatever.
Absolutely. It may not be FIT, it may not be NUnit, it may not be whatever, but if you could write a format, could be just CSV file, or could be just to look like a make file, some text file that the business person could say, I intend this.
Right.
You could generate your test, you could do whatever. I think the point of all of this, this discussion of test-driven development, is have a suite of tests. It gives you that constant feedback that the thing is still working.
Yeah.
Not just that it's working at a technical level, but that it's still doing the business that the business person who pays you is doing. But also that documentation, the kind of implicit documentation that, oh, it works like this. The unit test almost becomes documentation. It doesn't go out of date. It is how it works. If it passes, this is how the system works. If that looks like what a business person can understand, all the better, because then the business person can say, yes, it does work like this. And then all of the benefits of rapid and ruthless refactoring, ripping the guts out of an application is never a good idea, unless you have a whole bunch of code written in test format that confirms that you made it better.
Yeah.
You made it faster, you made it smaller, you made it more extensible, you made it whatever. If I change the application and test break, no benefit there at all. But then also the forcing you to think, if you're writing frameworks, forcing you to think like a client of this code, right?
Right.
One of the things that we didn't do on DOS Blog was think about anyone other than the DOS Blog team using the data access layer.
Mm.
If we had maybe done more tests, it would have looked like a different layer. It right now it's become very organic and it's extended and folded over on itself.
Yeah.
But it really was meant to be it should have been a public API that was formally tested, and we should have described it in our tests as the ideal. And then the ideal would have wagged the design and not it wouldn't have grown in such an organic way.
Yeah.
And then another thing that I found, last comment about test-driven development, is that if you spend a lot of time writing tests, rich language or not, dynamic language or not, strict compiler language or not, if you write a lot of tests, you spend less time debugging. A lot of people spend time stepping through their code, and they're just trying to get their head around, does it work right? But a test is a way to express, if it works right, this test will pass.
Yeah, I like what you said about thinking like a client. It gives you that from the client perspective that is often missing when you're in the middle of writing the goo.
Yeah, and then they don't care about stepping through it. They just want to know that it happens, and it happens fast.
Right.
So with some of these different unit testing frameworks, you can go and say, test this, and does it pass? Does it go? Does it take half a second? Does it take 10 milliseconds? Is that within spec? If not, what are we going to do about it?
Right.
Express your intent. Assert your assumptions. Anytime you say, this application must do this, anytime a business person has ever said it should behave like this, write a test.
Very good.
Cool.
Scott, that's a show.
We'll do one on mock objects soon. That's a great topic we could go on and on.
Absolutely. All right. And until then, we'll see you next week on Hansel Minutes. Mm-hmm.